Okay, we'll call our first case, which is case number 59639, Federal Insurance Company versus Coast Converters. We have Mr. Polzenberg on behalf of the appellant cross respondent, Mr. Lee on behalf of the respondent cross appellant. So, Mr. Polzenberg, you may proceed. And how much time would you like to reserve for
rebuttal? I'd like to try to save 5 minutes for rebuttal, Your Honor.
Thank you. You may proceed.
Good morning, Chief Justice Gibbons. May it please the court, Dan Polzenberg for Federal Insurance. It was error in this case for the district court to submit the Unfair Claims Practices Act claim to the jury. And the reason it's such an important issue is because it was presented as a strict liability alternative to the bad faith claim, and essentially plaintiffs argued they were entitled to the same damages without the necessity of proving any kind of state of mind. The jury returned a verdict for Federal on the bad faith claim, but against Federal on the Unfair Claims Practices Act. It is our submission that plaintiffs failed to make out a case under the Unfair Claims Practices Act, and at the very least that the case was improperly submitted, necessitating a new trial. The briefs go on and on about the requisite state of mind and what the legislature did in 1987 when it amended 686A310 and added subsection 2, which allowed a claim for any damages that resulted from a commission of any act that would be a violation of subsection 1 of the statute. This can't possibly mean any damages whatsoever. What it has to mean is that a plaintiff has a private right of action for any damages that result, as the statute says, result. And this means that are direct damages caused by the particular act. The error in this case was allowing plaintiffs to present it simply as a strict liability alternative without the necessity of showing bad faith. If you prove bad faith against an insurance company in the handling of a claim or in a coverage determination, you get consequential damages. This court held that you can get indirect consequential damages over and above contract damages. But the statute doesn't provide for that. So to make out a claim under the statute, you would have to show a particular act that violated the statute, the necessary state of mind for that act, because the statute does have the requirements of states of mind in some of its subsections. And then you need to show the particular damages that result from that act. Plaintiffs didn't attempt to do this. Now, the briefs have gone on and on about what state of mind is necessary. Plaintiffs argue that we conflate bad faith and an Unfair Claims Practices Act case. That's quite the opposite. I'm trying to show how they are different. And the federal court here in Nevada, in Pioneer Clore and in Hart, has pointed out that these are two different types of claims, that they have two different types of damages. So it simply cannot be an alternative claim where you're entitled to anything. So I think plaintiffs failed to prove causation, failed to prove damages. I also think they failed to show the necessary state of mind, but I don't think the court needs to get to that to show that I am entitled to judgment as a matter of law. And at the very least, there should be a new trial under this cause of action because it was submitted as a strict liability alternative. But it was really an afterthought at trial where it was presented. The arguments say, here's what we are entitled to, plaintiffs say, under bad faith. And, oh, yes, and we also get it. If you don't find bad faith, we also get it under the statute. That's not true. They don't. The main argument, the main basis for their Unfair Claims Practices Act was the fact that we treated this claim as being compensable under the BIEE coverage, business interruption extra expense, rather than under the BPP coverage, the building and personal property, which honestly I will just call the property damage provisions. The court said it was a close case on this coverage question. The court let the bad faith case go to the jury on that. Explained that bad faith required a degree of unreasonableness in a well-crafted jury instruction. The jury said we weren't unreasonable and yet did find that we were liable under the statute. And And I honestly, under the circumstances.
Mr. Folsenberg, yes, under 686A310, where do you find bad faith in the statutory language?
I don't. And that's what I'm saying. I'm not trying to say, and they criticize us in our opening, they criticize our opening brief for saying that we are saying, to quote Pat Cashel's words from the legislative history, that the statute is merely a recodification, or excuse me, a codification of a common law bad faith claim. While I do make the argument that there are certain requisite states of mind for each one of these subsections, I do argue that you have to prove bad faith to get consequential damages. I am not arguing that you have to show bad faith, common law bad faith, to get direct damages that would result under each one of these subsections. Take, for example, subsection 1A, misrepresenting to insureds or claimants pertinent facts or policy provisions relating to any coverage at issue. We've cited the cases all across the country that have similar provisions. This statute is taken from a model act from the National Association of Insurance Commissioners that have said that misrepresentation doesn't just mean that you've made a good faith error in interpreting a statute. You have to know that a fact or a policy provision is a certain way and deliberately misrepresent that it is another way. So that's as close, that is close to bad faith, but I'm not saying that it is bad faith. That's where they criticize me the most, but that is not what I'm saying. I'm saying that there are two different causes of action, as Judge Proh said in the Hart case, that there are some damages you can recover in an Unfair Claims Practices Act case you can't recover in bad faith, but there are a lot of damages you can recover in bad faith that you can't recover under the Unfair Claims Practices Act. Remember, what this statute started out as is subsection 1 was a series of provisions saying that these are certain acts that the insurance commission can seek penalties against an insurance company for committing. And then in 87, we added the provision that there's a private right of action for damages. Some of these will never have damages in the context of an individual claimant as opposed to an insurance company. For example, the provision that says that you have to have general standards for claims practices. That wouldn't result in damages in an individual case. But the subsection 2 doesn't set out what things you can get damages and what things you can't get. The federal court in Nevada has pointed out that some of these provisions would only give minimal damages. And that's the problem that I have here, is that their claim was that they didn't try to show what direct damages, and some of them would be minimal, and I've laid out at length in the reply brief why they don't get any damages, and they haven't shown any state of mind for the five provisions that they're putting up a fight on appeal. But there are elements that they have to prove, and this is a case of first impression. While the federal courts have interpreted our Nevada statute, even the United States Supreme Court in Humana versus Forsyth has interpreted our statute. This court has never had the opportunity to do that. The main issue that they argued that we had done wrong, as I was saying, was the coverage issue, whether it's covered as extra expense versus property damage. Judge Sturman said that was a close call on the coverage case. As a result, I don't think that should have gone to the jury on an Unfair Claims Practices Act or a bad faith claim. It's harmless on the bad faith claim since the jury found for us. But here I think it is clear that we properly handled this as extra expense as opposed to property damage. Property damage would be a claim where there was finished stock, where the bags were completely manufactured, and something happened to damage them when they were in inventory. If they're damaged in the process of manufacturing, if they're stock in process, then those really are extra. They're not property yet. They really are an extra expense in the manufacturing process. And one of the ways we know that is because Coast knew that they were having problems in the manufacturing process. They knew that their scrap rate had increased from 8% to 20%. They knew that there was a problem, and they decided to go ahead. The increase you have in cost in continuing your normal operations are the very definition of extra expense. So I don't think that we were wrong on the coverage issue. I think we were right on the coverage issue. I don't think that they have a cause of action for unfair claims practices. If we get an offset in this case for the amount we paid under one part of the policy for the judgment entered against us on the other part of the policy, plaintiffs don't even recover at all on their contract claim. So I think the case essentially, there was much ado about a case that really shouldn't result in a judgment against Federal. Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
Thank you, Mr. Polsenberg. Mr. Lee, you also have a right to reserve some time for your cross appeal. Did you wish to reserve any time? For
I do, Your Honor. Thank you. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes to address the reply on the cross appeal.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, David Lee on behalf of Coast Converters. One thing I want to note from the start is that I want to make sure that I take some time to address the cross appeal. I'll start where Mr. Polsenberg started, and that's with the Uniform Claims Practices Act. The way that, although we cite a lot of, Mr. Polsenberg cites a lot of cases from other jurisdictions and a lot of the Model Act, the problem with that analysis is it has to be taken on a state-by-state basis. Every case, every state has addressed the Model Practices Act and has modified it. Every state has addressed bad faith and has modified it. In the state of Nevada, according to all of the law that exists, both binding authority from this court and persuasive authority, defines those as two different things. The bad faith portion of the act is the decision that's ultimately made by the insurer. It has to do with the wrongful denial without a reasonable basis, knowing that the insurer had no reasonable basis. Those are the three elements that are required. And it always focuses on the decision itself. It, for sure, requires some type of mens rea type analysis. You are not liable, and the cases say this repeatedly, you are not liable for making the wrong decision if you did so with a reasonable basis. The Uniform Claims Practices Act is significantly different. It has to do with the analysis of whether or not you handled the claim properly and whether or not that handling or the improper handling resulted in damage to the insured. The example that I give is the bumbling insurance adjuster, and that is when 1987, when they created a private right of action, there is an insurance adjuster who, for whatever reason, not with any kind of negative intent, he keeps his files in the back of his car, and he loses some pieces of paper, and ultimately he doesn't adjust a claim in time, and as a result of that, it ultimately causes the company to go out of business or the claim to not be made. In that situation, the level of intent is actually specifically defined by the statute. And every section of 686A310 has a different level of intent that can be applied. Taking the plain meaning of the statute as drafted by the legislature, we have certain levels of intent, including 1A, misrepresenting. Well, that probably represents some level of intent. B, C, D, ultimately, just say failing to acknowledge and implement reasonable standards, failing to affirm or deny coverage. There's no level of intent there. It's a function of if you didn't do it, if you failed to do it, and as a result of that failure, damages have been suffered, the insured is entitled to recover for those damages. That's exactly what happened in this case. In this case, we had a claim that was made, and as a result, primarily of subsections D and E, failing to effectuate prompt and fair settlements, failing to affirm or deny coverage of claims within a reasonable time after proof of loss, my client was forced to go out of business, suffering to the tune, the jury found, of $5 million. It doesn't require an intent. And in fact, when Mr. Polsenberg refers to the Hart case and the Pioneer Chlor case, those cases, while not binding on this court, are very persuasive and spend a significant amount of time analyzing the difference between the statutes and ultimately coming, or different difference in the cause of action, and coming to completely different results. Bad faith is separate. There may be some facts that ultimately apply to both cases, but ultimately, bad faith is a common law decision based on whether or not you made an improper decision and whether or not you had an improper basis for doing it. The Uniform Claims Practices Act is just a function of whether or not you failed to do certain things. Next element is causation. And ultimately, one of the clearest violation of this is this claim was made in 2004, and there was substantial evidence before the court and before the jury that in 2004 enough evidence had been presented to Federal whereby Federal would have been required to pay almost $500,000 worth of property damage claims, the damage to the machines itself. Taking out the bags, taking out all of the fight about extra expense, damage to the machines themselves to the tune of $500,000. Do you know when that claim was paid? That claim was paid about 2 months before trial. 5 years into the claims process, actually almost 6 years into the claims process. And there was testimony during the course of trial that had they paid that claim in a timely basis, that the company would not have gone out of business and would not have suffered the damage it suffered. There was substantial evidence before the court and before the jury to come to the conclusion that Federal had violated the Claims Practices Act and that that violation led to directly led to damages by Coast, including going out of business to the tune of $5 million. The question as to whether or not they reached a policy decision, as Mr. Polsenberg pointed out, whether or not they reached the right determination on coverage is purely a function of the definition between property damage and extra expense. If I can explain this as buckets, over here we had a $2 million bucket for business interruption extra expense, and we had a $5 million bucket, at least a $5 million bucket, for property damage. Federal, in their attempt to adjust this claim to their benefit, put everything over into the $2 million bucket, including $1.28 million worth of bags that they are now asking for to be determined as an offset. During the course of the trial, it was presented to the jury, both by their accounting expert and by Coast's accounting expert, that that $1.28 million was really property damage and ultimately could have been fulfilled multiple times over. There was specific evidence presented to the jury that when it comes to issues of extra expense, that $1.7 million was the projected number between September of 03 and February of 04. Basically, a four-month period, in every single four-month period, another $1.7 million worth of business interruption extra expenses could have gone in to fill that bucket. And so they're not entitled to an offset for that amount of money because the jury already gave it to them. The next question, I think, ultimately comes to the offset issue, and this is what I want to try and talk about on the cross-appeal. Ultimately, Judge Sturman gave the benefit of $2.85 million worth of offsets to Federal based on primarily on the Western Technologies decision. In doing so, Judge Sturman created error. In order to, pursuant to the ruling of this court, there are three elements that must be met in order to entitle yourself to an offset pursuant to Western Technologies. Number one, you have to be a joint obligor. Number two, you have to have an offset based on the total damages claim. And number three, it has to apply to the same damages. The truth is, in this particular instance, none of those apply. Number one, a joint obligor. In the case A, where we pursued the electrical contractor and the design professional that implemented the design system for the electrical, that case ultimately was a claim based on primarily on lost profits. One of the things that we, and in no way, you were the joint obligor with an insurance company who provided insurance for a loss that ultimately paid a claim 8 years later. Second problem is it needs to be based on the total offset of damages. The total damages in this case exceeded $20 million, and that was what was presented to the jury. If, in fact, what we presented to the jury in this case was a claim for insurable losses. A moment ago, I spoke about the buckets. We have a $2 million bucket over here that is the maximum policy limits for business interruption and extra expense. That includes all of the lost profits of the company between 2003 and 2007 when they were ultimately forced out of business. That bucket, pursuant to the testimony that was raised during the course of the trial, could have been filled numerous times over. We didn't ultimately pursue any damages related to that bucket because we couldn't, as against Federal. As against Hyden and Delta and the other tortfeasors in the construction portion of the action, We were pursuing those damages and, in fact, ultimately recovered $2.85 million against the other tortfeasors with regard to lost damages, or I'm sorry, lost profits, extra expense, running two plants at the same time, additional recycling costs. There was more than enough and tons of substantial evidence in case in the bucket with regard to the $2 million of business interruption extra expense. Next, it has to actually reflect on the same damages, and it clearly does not. Based on the discussion in Western Technologies, the Federal is ultimately entitled to no offset. If, in fact, the court determines that there should be an offset, the court needs to look at the analysis of the offset-first approach. The law, and I'll stand in front of you and tell you right away that the law in Nevada currently is the Ramadanus case, a 1991 case. And the 1991 case applies an offset-first approach. Ultimately, I will tell you that this court is not bound by that decision because that decision applies to a completely different and distinguishable fact pattern. The Ramadanus case and most of the cases it relies on are cases where you have joint tortfeasors in the same case. In this case, we don't have joint tortfeasors in the same case. Secondly, it requires the same trigger, which usually is the filing of the complaint. We don't have that in this case either. The filing of the complaint in the Coast versus Federal case was not until 4 years after the resolution of claims in the Coast versus Delta case. As a result, we ask the court to apply the modified approach, which is found in the Newby case out of California and the Sutcliffe case out of North Dakota, which I believe to be the majority view. Frankly, Your Honors, I think you'll understand that this basically just requires a common sense approach. If you think of it as it happened in the Coast case, you have the breach of contract case filed against Federal, which relates back to the original breach, which was February of 2004. The jury ultimately found that was a $4 million claim. The settlement with Hyden in the construction defect portion of the case didn't happen until June of 2008. The interest under the modified approach, and frankly a common sense approach, should run from 2004 until 2008. At that point, there should be an interest calculation and a deduction, and then the interest should start to run again until a settlement with Delta in June of 2009. What Judge Sturman did here by applying the analysis the opposite way and giving Federal the benefit of the offset-first approach is that ultimately she gave them benefit as if they had paid the money in 2004. And frankly, that doesn't make sense from anyone's perspective. The last issue I want to touch on, because I don't think it's touched on briefly, properly in the briefs, is the attorney's fees issue. Federal's brief talks about the fact that there was no evidence of attorney's fees presented, and so pursuant to Sandy Valley, attorney's fees couldn't be awarded. Judge Sturman found completely the opposite. Judge Sturman found that the case was required, litigation was required, as a result of Federal's actions. And in fact, there is substantial evidence in the record that three different law firms had to be hired to pursue this claim to ultimately force Federal to make the right decision. There are dozens of exhibits in the record where there is a contest going on between Federal and Coast as to the definition of the policy provisions and the misrepresentations of those policy provisions made by Federal. Ultimately, Your Honors, there was substantial evidence in the record to support the verdict the jury came up with. And Federal is not entitled to any of the offsets pursuant to Western Technologies. Clearly, they're not entitled to the offset in the manner in which Judge Sturman applied it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. You have about 2 minutes for your rebuttal. Mr. Polzenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Let me take care of some of the smaller issues and get back to the Unfair Claims Practices Act. I am not going to address Mr. Lee's cross-appeal. And the offsets, and he pointed out that there are already two Nevada cases on point on his cross-appeal. But he did make the point that I'm not entitled to any offset whatsoever. And I have appealed the fact that I didn't get an offset for the $1.28 million that Federal already paid for this scrap claim under a different part of the policy. Apparently, the jury, which is, I maintain to this day, it's improper to have the jury decide coverage issues. But the jury decided it's covered under property damage. We paid it under extra expense. We didn't get the offset for the 1.28 we had paid. Let me take a second to explain offsets. In insurance, there are two types of offsets. There's an offset against limits, and there's an offset against damages. If you've made a payment under your policy under another part, it doesn't reduce the coverage that you have, but it does reduce the amount of damages to prevent a double recovery, not to prevent full recovery. After the offsets that the district court applied, they were entitled to $1.15 million. We'd already paid $1.28. We shouldn't have had to pay anything. They'd already been overcompensated. The remark about attorney's fees, they're claiming this is a Sandy Valley claim. They didn't plead attorney's fees except to say in their prayer for relief we should get attorney's fees, which isn't enough to
get. You know, Mr. Polzer, I might add that, you know, the courts, I know I am concerned about Sandy Valley and some of these attorney's fees as damages cases, you know, like that. We've had them in panel and all like that. So it was interesting what happened here and how these attorney's fees were dealt with. I understand your point, because if they're not, it wasn't pursuant to an offer of judgment or 18010 or, you know, the normal way you would get the attorney's fees, correct?
Exactly. We beat their offer of judgment, and they were left with nothing but a Sandy Valley claim that they hadn't presented to the jury. I don't think they have a claim for attorney's
fees. Do you think
fees.
The court should take another look at maybe a Greenspun and Sandy Valley and some of those attorney's fees and damages cases?
Honestly, I think Sandy Valley, and certainly its progeny, is pretty clear that what you have to do. Sandy Valley seemed to be a little broad at the time it was decided, but the court has moved back from that. So I don't really think this is a big issue in this case. I think the reason we have en banc argument, if I may be so presumptuous, is because this is the first case ever under the Unfair Claims Practices Act, and there's a fatal inconsistency in plaintiff's argument. They say that bad faith goes to the decision, the claims decision itself. But then they argue right now, had Federal paid in a timely manner, they wouldn't have gone out of business. That is the claims decision that we're talking about. That's what bad faith goes to. It's not just whether you pay or not. It's how you pay, how you handle the claim. This Court has made clear that it claims handling can fall under bad faith. But the particulars of the statute, they rely on subsection 1A, B, C, D, and I. None of these would allow a recovery of $5 million for going out of business. B is failure to acknowledge and act reasonably promptly upon communications. They make an argument that in all this extensive correspondence, we didn't answer one of their letters when they asked us to reconsider a determination that we had made. That didn't result in $5 million worth of damages. And that's Judge Pro's point. There are some claims that these are detailed, and Mr. Lee argues that today. These are detailed particulars of a claims handling that we, as a matter of law, want people to pay attention to. But it isn't the same scope and breadth as a bad faith claim. It doesn't give rise to the $5 million recovery they have here, and they didn't try to prove any particulars. Thank you, Mr. Chief.
Thank you very much. Mr. Lee, you have, I think, just a little over 2 minutes.
Thank you again, Chief Justice. Ultimately, the question of offsets, and I think perhaps that might be a muddled point in this case, there's two different offsets. There's the offset that Federal is asking for, the $1.28 million, and then there's the offset that we are asking for the court to take out, which is the $2.85 million. And I want to explain the difference. The $1.28 million really is a function of fact. It was put in front of the jury. It was $1.28 million that was paid for the bags, which the jury ultimately found to be property damage, but it was included in the extra expense bucket. As a result of that, that $1.28 million was moved over to the other, bucket. Not really. It should have been moved over to the other bucket. By taking it out of bucket A, the testimony that was clear from Cho and Oshiro and other people that testified at trial is that that bucket could have been filled up 10 times over. And that's ultimately what federal, that was what was argued to the jury. That was the facts that were put in front of them. What was paid in this bucket? What was paid in this bucket? What we asked for in this bucket was simply the remaining property damage dollars that we should have been entitled to. There's no, factually, there's no basis for an offset based on the $1.28 million. Similarly, our contention is there's no factual basis for the $2.85 million. These parties were not, they were not co-obligors. They were not paying for the same damages, and they were not paying for the total damages.
What's our standard review on that, though? The court, is it abuse of discretion when the court allowed the offset on the 2.85?
Ultimately, I would argue that the court misapplied the Western Technologies decision from this court, and so it should be reviewed de novo. The problem is the court applied a co-obligor status to an electrical contractor and the first-party insurer. The court did not consider whether or not they were paying for the same damages, and in fact, the record's pretty clear that ultimately, things that were not considered were attorney's fees and costs in the recovery in the first action. By allowing that $2.85 million deduction, it actually encourages the contract, the party breaching the contract, such as the insurer, to not pay the claim, because ultimately it cost my client $1.4 million in the manner in which the offsets were taken.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Lee. Mr. Paulsman, as always, we appreciate the outstanding arguments and briefs, and we will take this case under submission.